Welcome to the Joanne Averson podcast. This week, I'm really thrilled to publish an interview that I did last year in 2023 with Neil Thies. And I'm going to read you what it says on the flyleaf of his book, Notes on Complexity, that I believe should be an international treasure. Neil Thies is a professor of pathology at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Through his scientific research, he has been a pioneer of adult stem cell plasticity and the anatomy of the human interstitium. He is also a longtime student of Zen Buddhism. Dr. Thies's studies in complexity theory have led to interdisciplinary collaborations in fields such as integrative medicine, consciousness studies, and the science-religion dialogue. This is described as an electrifying introduction to complexity theory, the science of how complex systems behave, which profoundly reframes our understanding and illuminates our interconnectedness. Well, needless to say, any of you that know me know that that's one of the songs I've been singing for a very long time. And I remember the first time my dear friend and colleague, John Sharkey, met Neil Thies. And I remember him calling me in excitement saying, Neil has agreed to come to Dundee University and work with us, and you two are going to be friends for life. And I was like, seriously? And he said, seriously. And that's precisely what happened. Because I think Neil, and very definitely Notes on Complexity, are international treasures. Because somehow he links science and spirit in a way that serves every single one of us. But he does it in plain English. Now, I often like to wait after the big hubbub of an event to quietly let it mature and distill and, I suppose, a bit like a fine wine, become something very precious over time. And I knew that would happen with this particular piece of work. So when you listen to this podcast interview, you're going to hear quite a long introduction from me, because I wanted to deliver this podcast with all the enthusiasm and all the gratitude for Neil, but not from a sycophantic point of view, from an absolutely genuine respect and love for this man. He is extraordinary, and so is his book. Moreover, so is the gift that this book is to anyone listening to make sense of the work we all do in practice, of the lives that we live every day, and of the culture that we're in that is so keen to have research, regardless of understanding it, and that is so in need of the reuniting of what we learn with who we are and how we express it uniquely. Enjoy.
Neil, thank you for joining me today. And I want to tell you, I am sitting here with this book, and I have to tell you, I'm going to thank you on behalf not only of the world, but of the future generations that are going to benefit, not from the content, because the content is life, but from the way in which you have languaged and distinguished something as complex as complexity theory. Don't be put off by the title, anybody. You have to have this book. And you haven't simplified it. You've legitimized it in a way that is accessible to everybody. It is an unbelievable feat. I bow to you. And I don't say that lightly. I don't want to sound like I know what I'm talking about. But having written and argued with my own writing and written something, and then, you know, you've got the ghost of the angry listener or the ghost of the critical thinker or the tutor that you never pleased in junior school who wagged a finger at you and told you weren't methodical enough. And then you go back and rewrite it as if they're reading it. That torture. And you've somehow delivered scientific theory, a scientific theory of connection, consciousness, and being to the world in a way that we can cross the Rubicon from Renaissance thinking and reductionist methodology and everything that we want to call what gives us the anatomy and physiology and biomechanics that we live by, the holy trinity of physical sciences. And you've bridged it to the 21st century wisdom and understanding of consciousness and this challenge that we're facing in this century. It's a work of art, Neil. It's a work of art. Thank you. Seriously, I know I sound like a sycophantic idiot, but I am not.
No, or if my mother, may she rest in peace, if she were still here, I've had the advantage that the book represents something I've been speaking aloud for 20 years. You've heard me do it.
Yeah.
So the material has been rubbed up against people's common understandings and their questions for 20 years. So that's helped me bring clarity to my own ideas, though I thought initially, because I'm not a trained writer in any way, shape, or form, I write scientific papers, which is a completely other thing, that I thought I could simply sort of pour out the way I give the talk onto the page. Mm. And no,
yeah, doesn't work.
And so I had to learn, take what I had learned about the material and the concepts and how to present it. And I had really good editorial help to do this, obviously, so that nothing's taken for granted. As much as I could find, I could link every idea to the next idea, not assumed that anyone knew anything. And the challenge then is I have to figure out in under 175 pages how to explain quantum physics, relativity, biology, modern concepts of consciousness. And I did it.
Shaivism, Kabbalism, Advaita. I mean, just hang on a second. Because, I've known you a few years now and I've been studying fascia and anatomy and physiology and biomechanics, this holy trinity. And it just sent me nuts because it didn't make any sense to me. I've also had the privilege of being in a wisdom school, or you might call it a mystery school, for 6 years and studying spiritual science. And the big difficulty is the languaging process, the distinctions that you use to give people a bridge of understanding before they get to whether they agree with it or not. And that's what you've done. And you've made this web so exquisitely woven that nobody's going to lose their footing getting from the beginning to the end. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
No, seriously, it's more than brilliant, because you've managed to give us access to something that doesn't tell us what to think. It invites a new way of joining the dots of all the different ways of thinking that actually makes sense of our experience. Uh-huh. That, did you have any idea? And you've done it in plain English.
Yeah, good editing.
Don't blame anybody else. It's right. The essence is exquisite. It's exquisite.
Thank you. One of the things that has been difficult is, what's the elevator pitch for this book? Everything. And part of the reason is that, normally when I give an academic lecture, let's say on interstitium, I've got information that I want to convey, and everyone in the audience will receive that information at the same time. And by the end of the lecture, they will know what my conclusions are and how we got there. And pretty much everyone, if they didn't fall asleep, have followed the same story and come to the same vision that I have. And it's very straightforward. From the very beginning, the very first time I gave a formal talk of this, it was actually to my Zendo, where there are terrifically smart, sharp bunch of people, very eclectic, and they're safe for me to put new stuff in front of me. And I know they'll help me polish it, And that very first time, it was a very powerful evening for me because earlier in the week, I had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And to have only to go on this journey where by Friday morning, I found out that it was a misdiagnosis. And I just had an infection and they put me on antibiotics. And by nighttime, this lump in my neck had disappeared. But what I did during that week was create this talk. So I never forget sort of like, I needed to do that anyways. It was a happenstance at the beginning of the effort, you know. But so the presentation to my Zen group of this material, which is bridging that very first talk, bridged the science with the Buddhist metaphysics, emptiness of inherent existence, impermanence, karmic law, etc. That was the kernel of what became the entire talk eventually and the book itself. And it was not like any talk I had given to medical students teaching liver pathology or whatever, because instead of having a sense of I've got everyone with me and we're all going on this journey together, there were light bulbs going off in the room every minute or two. Yes. That people were finding different things in the material. And after, the questions just blew me away because everyone instantly was taking things further forward in ways I hadn't imagined. And I'd never given a talk that I experienced like that. It was like giving a Dharma talk, you know? And that's the way it's been through the 20 years of developing the ideas. The pleasure for me is just I get in front of an audience and I get ready to see the light bulbs going. You saw it in Dundee.
I saw it in Ohio. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, I have to tell this story. And then I've got about five quotes. I don't know if we'll get to them all, but there's five I want to ask you about because I can't tell you how many lines and marks and oh, my goodness, moments, as you say, light bulbs. But I remember when we were in Ohio and I have a decellularized leaf here. And Glenn Gaudet from Boston College was showing us this exquisite work that they've done where they discovered the leaf. I'm just telling this for my listeners that the decellularized leaf, in other words, if you imagine dipping a leaf in something that took away all that's green and just left you with the skeleton of the vein system, the arterial pathways, the veins that you see in a leaf, that's all that's left. And they were seeing if this could be used with, if I've got this correct me if I'm wrong, Neil, you were there too. They were putting stem cells, working with rats, putting stem cells of a given rat, and then using a piece of this to transplant under the skin of the rat to see if it would accept the material. The future of this being the possibility of using this tissue with human stem cells to repair things like hearts and really subtle body tissues that cost an absolute fortune to replace with heart tissue, but not if you could create transplant fabric like making human tissue
from leaves.
From a spinach leaf, for goodness sake. Yeah, and it was spinach. Such incredible work, blown away. And we're standing in Ohio. There's about 30 of us there. And Glenn Gaudet, he's a professor at Boston College and a brilliant man, doesn't know who you are. He knows of you and knows you're there, but doesn't know which person in the audience is you.
Which I was not aware of.
But what happened was he put up a slide of their post image of the tissue after the leaf had been, the tissue they'd made had been transplanted into the rat to see if it had accepted the transplant or not. I think that was the key. Mm-hmm. And he was simply showing that slide as their methodology in their experimentation. And you suddenly stood up and wandered to the front of the room, completely under the spell of this slide that was huge on the lab wall. And you looked up and he was like looking around the room as if to say, what's going on here? And looking at me and John Sharkey to see if we were actually going to do anything. And we're both grinning our heads off because we can't wait to see what you're going to say or hear what you're going to say. And you just looked at it and you pointed at it and you did a lot of whatever was going on in Neil's world. You read things we don't even know names of. And you went, it worked. And he went, sorry? And you said, it worked. And you pointed at it. And you said, it worked. The interstitium of the leaf has been accepted by the interstitium of the rat tissue.
the in-between has accepted the in-between. It hasn't put a barrier around this foreign in-between. And I cannot tell you the energy in the room. It was like a moment in history being made. It was, you know how John absolutely loves creating and facilitating these connections. And we were literally watching connective tissue forming across the world of biochemistry and liver pathology and genius and excitement and possibility. And I saw it alive in front of me, this brilliant commitment to joining the dots for people to make a difference in the world. And you know, I love you to pieces. And that was just one of the moments in my professional career when the magic of science and understanding and awareness came together in a moment of energetic commitment in a whole group, and magic happened. What you talk about here, this,
you know, I don't know exactly why my brain, who does, why my brain works the way it does, but it may be by training, it may be by lineage. But the way I work, it's not very good for getting grants. For getting grants, you have to think in a very orderly sort of way. A leads to B, B leads to C, et cetera. What I do is, what I'm comfortable with and always have been, is I gather stuff up and associations start to form. Sometimes those are meaningless, and sometimes it turns out they have legs. It's very much, I say lineage because I come from, on my mom's side, a very long line of very prestigious rabbis going back a couple of thousand years. And, well, a thousand. And then it gets murky. And the rabbinic approach is one of association. It's not the Greek approach of logical progress through an argument. It's associative progress. And so when I'm sitting there listening to someone speaking in a different scientific language about different things that are separate from mine, I'm looking for associations.
Yeah.
And I've learned to trust. When I see an association that seems rich, potentially rich, I go there. What complexity theory did, coming back to the book, It's been exactly that moment you experienced. I've had 20 years of moments like that, as all the things I studied. You know, there's stuff in here that I learned in this book when I learned when I was 14. And now that's quantum physics and relativity. So that's what kind of 14-year-old I was. And biology and chemistry, all the stuff I was almost went to rabbinical school. So there was a lot of Jewish studies in there, but I also was interested in computer science and systems theory. So I did that, and I was pre-med. So I learned that stuff. Then I went to medical school, and then just reading. I've just collected stuff all my life without any particular purpose. And when I got to complexity theory, it turned out that all of this stuff, one thing could be threaded to another thing with the complexity theory. And as I kept going, I was realizing I was stringing together everything I knew, however I acquired that knowledge over a lifetime. So this book, it only really hit me when the last version was closed that, oh, this book represents a lifetime of learning for me. Everything I have, I put in this book, with a few exceptions which are saved for the possibility of another.
There has to be. I'm going to read a little piece. I've got a few here, and I want to ask, this was one that just got me. And it to me, it speaks the whole book. And it's the microcosm of the macrocosm of what you've just said. And it's page 5. It says, the universe is a shimmering web of complexity that continually births and nurtures life, tempting us to believe that life might even be its central purpose and most fundamental expression. How can you?
Yeah.
Drop the mic. Because that shimmering web of complexity is, I mean, who could take on the in-between? And bring it in science to our awareness and make it scientific and spiritual at the same time. That's what you've done.
I hope so.
You did that. And let's ground this a bit, because obviously the second half of the book was I love all of it, but my most favorite was you make this very gentle journey from science to spirituality without being soppy spiritual. You very clearly and quietly just say, right, let's look at these four ideas, Kabbalism and Advaita and so on, and you look at them as examples, but you manage to pricey them just enough for us to use them as stepping stones across the Rubicon, not enough to lose us down any rabbit holes, and you keep that level throughout the book. It's a feat. It's absolutely unbelievable. One of the things that, there's so much here, but anyway, Gödel's accomplishment with the incompleteness theorems then was not simply to prove or disprove one particular arcane question about the Hilbert program. I'm throwing us straight into a later chapter about logic. It was much more ambitious. By reasserting the importance of intuition in our scientific understanding of the structure and function of the universe, Gödel was able to restore mental intuition to respectability as a means of assessing truths, reopening science to at least consider insights from philosophy and, alas for the Vienna Circle, metaphysics. Such insights and speculations, if rigorously obtained, were now acceptable, even necessary, modes of knowing truth. That's chutzpah. I can't even tell you.
But it was Gödel's chutzpah. You know, it was Gödel's chutzpah. And talk about clarity of thought. So Kurt Gödel was a logician, philosopher, mathematician, wannabe physicist at one time in Vienna, and was admitted to this group of philosophers, scientists, sociologists, mathematicians called the Vienna Circle. And the Vienna Circle's main purpose was seeing the collapse of medieval church-based society in Europe. And with the rise of Newtonian mechanics and the Industrial Revolution, making literal machines became the dominant metaphor for the universe and for the human body, etc. And machines can be utterly predictable. And so they wanted to eliminate anything they called dismissively metaphysics. You know, if they had an argument over a point with someone, the worst insult they could hurl at each other was metaphysics. They stated as coherently and carefully as anyone was capable of doing that the only way to understand truths of the universe was either through formal mathematical logic, building up logical mathematical proofs that eventually, using mathematics, you could describe the entire machinery of existence and predict everything, ultimately. That sort of was an implicit thing. And you had to be able to do this absolutely, completely, covering everything, nothing left out, with entirely consistent with itself. So there could be no internal contradictions. And everyone agreed that was possible, and it would just take some time. The other side of this was using science, empirical science, to understand the world. And they very carefully defined it as the experimenter, separate from the object of observation, separate from the subject, and thereby obtaining truths about existence as well. And so this is the worldview. This is our modern cultural view that everyone sort of buys into, even people who have spiritual inclinations. If you stop them quickly on the street and surprise them and say, are science and math the best ways of understanding the universe? We say yes. And there's this materialist worldview that we're soaked in. And it's obviously very successful. We have things like cell phones. We have a Zoom thing going on here. We've got antibiotics. You know, it works for a lot of things. But this idea that empirical science and formal mathematical logic can solve everything turns out not to be the case. And within a few years of their statements of these ideals, they were completely shattered. And yet they still dominate us for a variety of historical reasons, which I talk about in the book. But first of all, there was quantum physics, which said, at least at the quantum level, there is no separation between subject and object. Max Planck, the father of quantum physics himself, said, there is no getting behind consciousness, meaning that it's consciousness, the conscious observation, that establishes the nature of reality. And therefore, there is no absolute separation of subject and object. And many people, myself included with some of my collaborators, have talked about this. This isn't just a quantum phenomenon. It propagates up through all living systems, at least biological. So empirical science doesn't do the trick. Then Gödel comes along. I mean, at least we've got mathematics. We know mathematics will work. And the thing about Gödel was he was what's called a mathematical Platonist. So you love the Platonic idea.
To put anything Platonic, you know, I'm nuts about it.
Right. And so there are people like the Vienna Circle who felt that numbers were inventions by humans for counting. And then for more complex things. So numbers were invented to count bushels of wheat or stars in the sky or whatever. And then we go from there and we build up mathematics as we go. Mathematical Platonists say, no. Mathematics exists out there in a Platonic realm that we can perceive and we can discover mathematical truths. We don't create mathematical truths. And
We wake up to the recognition of zero. It's like with the, you know, the Roman numerals starting at one, and then the discovery of zero as a placeholder suddenly transforms. But it was a discovery. It was a recognition of something.
Well, some people would say it was an invention.
I see what you're saying. Some and it's a discovery, some it's invention, yeah.
And how do you settle that question?
Yeah.
Gödel found a way.
Okay.
So when I mentioned in the text you read about the Hilbert program, so he was sort of the leader of modern mathematical logic. And he said, in order to accomplish this aim of mathematics explaining everything, it had to fulfill certain criteria and achieve certain tasks. One of those was, as we said, it has to be complete. It has to describe everything. Mathematics has to encompass everything, nothing left out. And it has to be completely consistent with itself. There can be no internal contradictions, because if you have an internal contradiction, then the whole logical thing can unravel. What Gödel showed in the most remarkable way, and I give a glimpse of it in the book, is that he proved that there are always going to be, if you have a system of mathematical logic, in his particular case, if it was one that contained arithmetic, it's been generalized since, but his first version, any formal system of mathematical logic that contained arithmetic, there would always be statements that were true that could not be proven from within the program. Which means, how would you know they were true? He showed that they are true, but the only way you can get there is by intuition. There can be no formal proof of those things. Then the reverse, he also showed that if, in fact, you have a mathematical system that encompasses everything, nothing left out. So everything that can be proven true is proven true within it. It will contradict itself, and therefore its logic will unravel. So the next iteration of this, famously, is Alan Turing with the Universal Turing Machine, which is the basis of modern computing. So Gödel's work sort of was the foundation on which computer science exploded. So he wasn't some, you know, off-kilter, off-in-the-corner specialist. His work was incredibly profound. But what it's most profound for is mathematics cannot explain everything. Science cannot explain everything. There are truths that cannot be approached by either, that cannot be encompassed by either. In which case, how do we encompass them? And Gödel himself described how he encountered mathematics as this realm beyond him to be explored through his intuition. He would lie down on a couch in a darkened room and quietly let the objects of mathematics come to him. Mm-hmm. He was a meditator. He taught himself how to do this. He had no formal training that anyone knows about. And he himself said in a letter to his mother, he wrote many interesting letters to his mother, that he imagined that appropriately these ideas would be useful for religion. So I'm simply taking up that, what he gave us, and seeing where I can go with that. And that's the latter half of the book.
Well, what's so beautiful about it, and I, you know, we've just gone deep into the reasoning behind Gödel and with his position. What you've done so brilliantly in the book is you haven't made it a dense book on information structure, and you know, this isn't a romp. This book is a relatively easy read, and I wasn't expecting that. I rearranged to do this podcast sometime after I received the book to give me weeks to devour it, and I couldn't put it down because it was like you took me by the hand through a forest and said, right, that clearing over there is this, and that set of trees over there is this, and this is the undergrowth. What you've got to understand is they come together here, and we need to bridge this way. But you keep moving. You don't get stuck down any rabbit holes, which I'm just, anyone out there listening, I can't even tell you. It's absolutely beautiful. And you talk about the three different systems of emergence, of complexity, shimmering web. You talk about the whole equals the sum of the parts. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And living beings, it's complexity theory. And you talk about it in terms of ants, which is something that we can all relate to.
Well, that's, you know, years of giving this talk, I was introduced to them by ants. Everyone understands ants and ant colonies. And Jane Prophet, this artist who I was collaborating with, she introduced me to complexity theory. That's a long story. But without her, there'd be no book and my life would have been different. But she first started talking about ants. And I remember my first experience hearing it. I love ants. Growing up and seeing ants running around, you know, and then ants get into the house and you have to decide, are you on your mother's side or are you on the side of the ants? You know, it was my first vivid proto-Buddhist moment was like seeing an ant in her kitchen and scooping it up on some tissue and carrying it outside, because I knew my mother was not only going to kill it, but call the exterminator. The story's in the book. But the thing is that ants are everywhere. There isn't a human. Whenever I give this talk and start talking about ants, you watch the audience smile and relax. It's another one of the routine pleasures I get from sharing this material. They're a good example that everyone understands, and it takes them back to their childhood. And I think that's important for the material because, to some extent, the web of connections I followed, the drive to do that came from that kind of primal pleasure of childlike discovery. I was discovering new worlds, except it was the world around me. And ants are a good way to reset people into that space, because we were all there at one point. We just mostly don't remember it or don't know how to get back to it.
But that's what I love about this, is that, you know, I get quite nervous myself when trying to do a presentation or listen to somebody talking. We get so caught up in the intellectualization of it. And you know, I'm a movement teacher, I'm a manual therapist, and you work with doctors who have to do things with people in the field. That's in present time.
Yeah.
That's not historical time. That's not data and quantity based. That's now. That's the quality of the now that any meditative practice seeks to deepen and expand and bring us to. And what you've managed to do in the book is write it in a way that's like a living language. It's like you're in the present moment being taken by the hand through this, you know, plotting the journey of the scientific ethos. I don't know what the plural of ethos is, but through them all, and you plot them and weave them together, and they pop back up throughout the book like it's a story. I mean, you're such a consummate storyteller. And then you go into the return of metaphysics, where you talk about a practitioner of both science and meditation should always be vigilant to maintain a skeptical eye, even when their meditative experiences are exceptionally vivid or even life-altering. And so you're not saying, oh, by the way, all this science, we abandon reductionism, and now we're all going off with the fairies to count stars in our sleep and find the nothingness from which we came. You know, it's like you take us there really lovingly and carefully, and you choose these four traditions that we talked about. There's nothing particularly special about these four traditions that we chose to explore in depth. They're simply the ones with which He being your friend Menas, he or I are most familiar through direct initiation and practice or academic interest. There are so many others, of course, and I invite you to look to whatever traditions you're familiar with for similar or related views. And you've managed to, let's say there's the past, there's the present that we're in, and there's the possibility of the, whatever you want to call, we call it the future, but for me it's that other, that intuitive realm, let's call it that. You manage to point to the intuitive realm without dictating how it should be. And yet invite us to take it seriously, to consider it as valid an initiation as the academic achievements of understanding theory. And what I love about it is it's like, in my mind, it was like the shape of a Möbius loop. Where, you know, we talk about the left-hand side being the history and the right-hand side being the mystery, but the knot in the middle is where you are in the book. And you've managed to write that in a living language. And in reaching deep within ourselves to contact this primordial realm, we can have influence upon it, becoming a partner with God in refining all creation toward purity, perfection, and peace. I know you're not talking about God as if God is some, you know, geezer with a pair of glasses on the end of his nose and a Christmas list ticking off who's behaving properly. We're talking about consciousness with a capital C, to quote you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where the founder of the movement I'm part of calls that our portable paradise within. And that's what I was in tears actually, because you take us within and you make it safe, not to be religious necessarily, but through reflections of different religions to spiritual awareness, but you treat it sacredly.
Well, you know, listen, it took a lot of work to get here. There are a lot of things in our culture and in my own life that work hard to pull things apart and to say that things are separate. You know, the most vivid things, you and I have spoken about all of this stuff. The most vivid things for me growing up Jewish in very Christian New England, growing up a child of Holocaust survivors, first generation American with European parents, growing up gay in a straight family. And for many years, you know, life was very hard for me because I couldn't find any way to bring all these things together. In fact, pieces of me were being pulled at each other to tear things apart. It was sometime in my 20s, growing up, coming of age, I went to medical school in New York, and that's where I came out and came of age as a gay man, and it was the AIDS crisis. And I used to joke to people, being a medical student and then an MD, I'm extremely useful in medical situations and medical emergencies. And we were living with daily medical crises. And I made a joke at the time that I never felt completely myself as I did when sitting by the bedside of a dying friend, because then the Jewish part and the Buddhist part and the gay part and the medical part all were in there together. No separation. And once you get a taste of that, you realize it doesn't have to be other than that. And I wasn't going to give up on feeling that through my life. The care about being careful regarding you can't jump to conclusions this way, but you can't jump to conclusions this way. I'm a Zen Buddhist, the middle way. There's a middle way through all this stuff that allows them to be threaded together where they support and they mutually support each other rather than bounce up each other and fly
away.
And
they also look to honor each other rather than discredit and dismiss each other. And that's what I love about this book, is it's such a powerful tool to translate. You're not saying, no, the science is wrong. And you're not saying, no, the awareness is wrong. You're not saying it's either of them are right. You're inviting us to meld our personal experience in presence to be present to the in-between. I mean, how middle way can you get? I remember one of the moments in my career when Jaap van der Waal turned around and said, the body's made up of three things, cells, connective tissues, and the in-between. I was like, yes, my moment. You know, now it makes sense. And you've somehow done that with the science, the intuitive or the spirituality, the awareness, the consciousness. I know they're not synonymous terms by any means, but with the presence.
Yeah.
But it's your presence in the writing that you've somehow imbued permission. I don't know how you've done it.
Thank you. I don't know how it was gifted to me or why, but it was. One of the stories that cut, there's a bunch of good stories that got cut.
It's gorgeous.
But one of them is, you know, I had no particular interest in finding a weaving between science and spirituality. I was fine with them being separate in my head, mutually supportive, but not having any serious relationship with each other. And it was complexity theory that dissolved the barriers between them. And it came at me as a surprise because I was not looking for it. And it came as a surprise sitting in our Zendo. I was the morning opener. And that particular day, no one else was there. I was alone in the Zendo. And instead of doing my assigned meditation practice, which at the time was following my breath, I had been obsessing about my stem cell research and just could not turn off. This was 20 years ago. And science. and starting to realize that the cells I was studying for this short time I did animal work, and now continually still looking at human tissues, that I was the thing I was studying. Mm. There's a moment in the weeks before this particular gift where I was stuck in my, I'm the cells I'm studying, my body is cells, my body is a flock of cells, self-organizing into what looks like a body. And I was standing at the corner in New York and the traffic light changed and it said walk, and people stepped off to the street and I couldn't step off because my leg had become a flock of cells. It took me a while to pull it back together into a leg. So this came into me in the Zendo. And there was a moment where I looked up, zooming around in my mind, I'm cells, and saw the stick of incense on the altar opposite becoming smoke. And it just, this is what Buddhists mean by emptiness of inherent existence. You are a body. You are cells. The incense is a stick. It is also the smoke. Both are equally true. If you try to grab one of them, you lose the other. And suddenly my stem cell work and complexity, the thing self-organized, gave me this insight into a really obscure little bit of Buddhist metaphysics. And I took it to my teacher the next chance I got. And I said, that's all it is? That's emptiness? And she said, yeah. I said, I'm kind of surprised. And she said, well, it's really simple. It's just not easy. But that was the, suddenly there were no barriers. And everything in the book really flowed from that moment.
Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my soul for writing it and sticking it and putting it on paper and going through all that it takes. Just seriously, it's incredible. And I'm going to read it again, and I'm going to tell everybody to read it again. Just get this book, Notes on Complexity, and it's a scientific theory of connection, consciousness, and being. And if that isn't the holy trinity of the future, I don't know what is. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you, Joy.
So there you have it. A complete podcast interview with Neil Thies. And if you haven't met him in person or you haven't seen him present, then I'm very excited to tell you that at the Move Better, Feel Better Summit, he will be the keynote speaker in May 2024. There'll be a link in the show notes for you to find out about that for yourself. And I believe you have free access to Neil and to a number of other speakers. I'm very delighted to be privileged to be among them. And the work of Cynthia Allen, bringing forward Feldenkrais into the world. Please don't worry if you're not familiar with Feldenkrais. You don't need to be. Cynthia Allen, founder and inspiration behind the Move Better, Feel Better summits, is dedicated to the same things that Neil Thies is dedicated to, and the same things that I'm dedicated to, and most of us, making a difference in the world to ourselves and our clients to the best of our ability at the time. There's gold in this summit. Enjoy.